From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has prided himself on promoting the concept of religious liberty as part of his presidency. His administration has privileged religious groups, and a conservative-leaning Supreme Court has affirmed that push. Indeed, the U.S. Constitution offers strong protections for religious freedom. But it turns out that not all religions seem to enjoy constitutional protections and the legal precedents equally. Unsurprisingly, the religious demands, practices, and beliefs of white Christians dominate the American landscape. Examining the history of how this has come to be in a new book is my guest, Kiyathi Joshi. She's a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, author of New Roots in America, Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, and co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, the third edition. Her book is called White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. Welcome to the program, Kiyathi.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
So you write in your book using this term that I hadn't really heard before, but I think is a really useful place to start, which is Christian normativity. Tell me what you mean by that. I'm assuming that it's sort of how when we talk about race, how whiteness is considered, quote unquote, normal.
Yeah, it's really about how Christian ways, Christian language, Christian ways of believing, Christian ways of worshiping are just considered normal, right? So for example, the way that when the media talks about prayer or somebody's talking about prayer, prayer is, you know, sitting in a pew, hands folded, you know, head bowed, perhaps. It's not necessarily, one doesn't conjure up the image of my parents at the Hindu temple prostrating themselves in front of the deities, you know. So it is really about how Christian ways become the normal way of doing things. And that really does put religious minority groups at a disadvantage.
So let's talk about history, because that's your book focuses primarily on that. Where do you start the story of how Christian normativity began in the United States, where the religion of white Christians and their beliefs really laid the groundwork for the country?
So the one thing I'll say is the book focuses a lot on history and law. And then I also talk about what it looks like today and what are the ramifications. So I would want your listeners and viewers to know that it's not just a history book. That's really important. But to answer your question, we can't talk about religious freedom and the First Amendment and without talking about really race also. One of the arguments I have in the book is that actually race and religion, whiteness and Christianity, kind of go hand in hand. And Christianity has had a huge role in the construction of white supremacy, in the construction of racism. So really, we have to go back to the Iberian Peninsula in 1400s, Spain and Portugal, and see how religion became racialized with what happened with Jews and Muslims at the time called Moors there, and what happened because you had a group who were conversos, who like Jews who converted, for example, and Moriscos was the term given to Muslims who converted. But here's the thing, Sonali, they were really never considered real Christians, because it was believed that to be Jewish was in the blood, or to be Muslim was in the blood. This, now we're going to fast forward a couple of centuries, and we see religion morphing into our modern concept of race. Our modern concept of race really comes about in the 1500s with all of this. And before we talk about black and white in history, we have the language of civilized and uncivilized, and we have the language of Christian and heathen. And so the Native Americans were uncivilized and not Christian. They were heathens and got put into a category. Africans who were enslaved and brought to the Western Hemisphere were not Christian necessarily. Some could have been, and they were not European. They were not white. So they were, of course, you know, to say they were marginalized is putting it lightly and not doing it justice. But I'm trying to make the point of how these terms go together. And then we ultimately see this even with what happens with Hispanic and Asian groups. And I go into a fair amount of detail around Hispanic and Asian groups because I focus on immigration and citizenship in the 1800s and into the 20th century on how race and religion, whiteness and Christianity went together to create groups who were othered.
So let's talk about non-white Christians, because this is an important aspect of it. I mean, white Christian extremists in the United States might not be very aware of the fact that there are non-white Christians all over the world, including in predominantly Muslim countries or predominantly Hindu countries or etc. Barack Obama was a non-white Christian, and you write about him in your book. How did Obama confound the white Christian extremist base that, you know, ended up supporting a president like Trump? They desperately wanted to identify his middle name, Hussein, which was, of course, an identifier of an ancestry that was Muslim.
That's right. That's right. Actually, President Obama is how I start the section of the book when I'm talking about citizenship, because what he had to endure in terms of his citizenship being questioned, his patriotism being questioned, was just terrible, was just ridiculous. But yeah, there's a four points to look at there. Number one is the fact that he was his middle name, as you brought up, right? Then there is the issue of his father. His father was not born in the United States. His father was not a U.S. citizen. His father was from Kenya. And the media, especially the conservative media that wanted to portray President Obama as not American, would often show, in some cases, we're not sure if they were really even his relatives in Kenya, but just to show almost the backwardness of Africans. And it was very horrible, and it was incredibly stereotypical, biased, and discriminatory. Then there was the issue that President Obama had spent time in Asia during his growing up years, right? And Asians have often been thought of as forever foreigner. You know, gosh, they're never, you know, as an Asian American, we're never going to fit in. We're often seen from over there. And then finally, the fact that, you know, he would often say, oh, I go to church, I go to church. But he went to a church where a pastor practiced liberation theology. This was not the kind of church that white Christian Americans go to. Therefore, it was unfamiliar territory to them. And that became an issue. So there were so many ways. And unfortunately, he provides the perfect illustration to talk about citizenship in a variety of ways. But we can see exactly the way, if you take those four pathways, the number of ways that people in America are shown to be not American and, you know, constantly othered.
The United States is supposed to be a secular country that still respects religious freedoms and respects the fact that there are, you know, many religions and that people's religious beliefs do need to be respected, but there is supposed to be a separation between church and state. So what does the Constitution actually say? Because that's important for us to think about when we look at how different religions might be treated differently. What does the Constitution actually say about the practice of religion and how it enters into the conversation?
Well, we have in the First Amendment, the religion clause is broken up into two clauses, the free exercise clause and the establishment clause. And basically one keeps government out of religion and the other one keeps religion out of government. All right. The whole phrase separation of church and state is nowhere in any of America's founding documents. That was actually written in a letter by Thomas Jefferson to a congregation. And that phrase has become part of popular culture, if you will, and it, because the Supreme Court used it in one of their decisions on separating, taking prayer and the reading of the Bible out of school. Okay, and that's another important thing. In the 50s and the 60s, we had cases that took prayer and the reading of the Bible out of school. It didn't take religion out of school, but that got understood as government taking religion out of school. And that's actually one of the reasons we're in the pickle we're in today, because we don't learn about different religions in school most of the time in US public schools. And I would say that even sometimes so many world events are taught where we don't have a proper understanding of how religion has influenced those historical events. So you can't really get the whole story, and that's something that really needs to change.
So you talk about how the way, how the Christian practice of religion as being a little bit different from when some other religions practice is also interwoven into legal precedents. You write that, because often Christians engage in or their faith is shaped by their belief rather than certain practices. They may go to church, but really it's their beliefs in, say, Jesus Christ, as opposed to, say, a Muslim whose practices of maybe wearing a hijab or not eating pork. Those differences are manifest in the laws that protect religious minorities. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, and that really shows the Christian hegemony that exists, right? The way, and when I say Christian hegemony, what that's referring to really is just the way that Christianity is in all the nooks and crevices, nooks and crannies of our of laws, okay? And also our culture. So for example, in Christian faiths, there is no requirement of a head covering. So that when Jews who are observant, men who wear kippah, or Sikhs who wear turbans, or Muslim women who wear hijab, when they want to do certain things and keep their head covering, it has become an issue. Jews and Sikhs have had to fight to be in the military, to be in the military to be able to practice their faith, engage in their, wear the head covering like they are supposed to by their religion, as they believe it to be, and still serve, right? We have so many cases of Sikh men wanting to serve as police officers, and it's often lawsuits on a case-by-case basis. If we actually had, if Christian denominations had something in the religion that said, you must have an head covering, this would not be an issue for other religions.
Right. So we imagine that today all religions are allowed to practice freely, that even if white Christianity formed the underpinnings of the origins of this country, that today it's all about religious liberty. And indeed, the Trump administration uses that term religious liberty a lot. It's even something that they promote internationally. State Secretary Mike Pompeo has talked about it quite a bit. He's, someone who's seems to be driven by his Christian religious beliefs. So they talk about religious liberty a lot, but they're generally talking about Christianity, right? Because I imagine oftentimes when they have photo ops, when Trump and his cabinet have photo ops with Christian leaders, you wouldn't, never imagine seeing them having similar photo ops with, say, primarily Muslim groups, or the same kinds of privileges that they fight for Christian groups to have if it was a Muslim organization or a Muslim person at a bakery who didn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple. That you wouldn't see the right-wing groups fighting for that religious, you know, minority.
Well, Sonali, we can hope, right? We could hope, but you're absolutely right. And you know what I'll say is that the religious right and the conservative segment of Christian America, they are very good at messaging, and they are very good at marketing their ideas. So they have co-opted this idea of religious liberty and religious freedom. So what do they say? They will often say that we are the ones persecuted because we are not allowed to be show our faith and practice freely because people judge us. Now, I want to be clear that I do think there is a bias against religion in this country in certain segments of America. And I would say, for example, at colleges and universities, I would say we have one.
How so?
Well, you know, if you're religious, and I'll say honestly here, not just Christian, but other religious backgrounds out there. Also, if you're religious, you're kind of looked at a little differently, you know, because it's almost like folks who are intellectual maybe should know better. And that's unfortunate.
Are you talking about in academia, that there's a bias against academics who are religious?
I'm talking about the idea of being religious in academia. There are biases there. And so I'm not saying that someone who isn't evangelical, hasn't faced discrimination, like by somebody said something to them or whatever, maybe because they were praying or something like that. But they don't have the institutional support behind them, because Christianity is infused in our public policy, in our laws and Supreme Court decisions. So, the idea that they have to fight for religious freedom is a farce. It is an absolute farce. But I did want to kind of, you know, nuance the argument a little bit and talk about the fact that in reality, we do know that there is an anti-religion sentiment in segments of our society.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that, but I want to talk to you about immigration policy. You mentioned earlier that there is a very intimate relationship between Christianity and whiteness. Of course, the issue of race comes into it deeply. Your book is called White Christian Privilege, not Christian Privilege. How have our immigration policies over the years privileged Christian immigrants and light-skinned Christian immigrants?
Yeah. So the two the two events I can bring up are both immigration laws that really tell the story very well. And one is the Immigration Act of 1917, which created a barred zone from Asia. So most of Asia, immigrants from most of Asia were barred from coming to the United States after 1917. Okay, now you have to think about what are the religious groups of the people who might have come. Let me be clear, the act, the law, says nothing about religion, all right? Then you have to look at what happened in 1924. We severely curtailed immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. Now, look at the religious backgrounds of those immigrants that would have arrived. They would have been predominantly Jewish, Catholic, and Eastern Orthodox. Okay, so 1917 shut the door. Imagine shutting the door. 1924, we close the door and kind of stick a foot in there to kind of keep it shimmied open. Okay, now it's almost like a mathematical equation. When you put 1917 together with 1924, you see that we are trying to create a white Protestant nation with the groups who are being excluded. And then we can fast forward to just a couple of years ago with the executive order signed by the current president in January 2017, referred to as the Muslim ban. The exact number is escaping me right now. And that harks back immediately to what we did in 1917 with Asian immigrants. Again, the executive order doesn't say one word about religion, but the actual impact has a lot to do with the religious backgrounds of those refugees and others coming in. So we have to apply, for those who are familiar with critical race theory, we have to apply that lens, which is you read the law, you see it, but then you have to understand the impact of it also in reality.
So today we have a right-wing extremist white Christian base that President Trump relies on for political power, who have also created this mythology about Sharia law creeping through America, ready to, you know, radicalize our children and cover our women with hijabs. This kind of fear mongering is very much linked to racism in America, right? I mean, this also seems to be something that you can characterize as white Christian privilege at work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have the racialization of religion, right? Which is where we see that, especially since 9/11, although it was happening actually since the, you know, Iran hostage crisis in 1979 and the issues with oil from the Middle East, that brown skin, having brown skin equals Islam, which means you're a terrorist, right? And you can't be trusted. You're questioned constantly. Your life's on the line, especially for men. So there's absolutely no question about the racialization of religion. And unfortunately, we live during a time and we have leaders who are able to weaponize religion. They have weaponized Christianity to work against everyone else who's not Christian, further showing just how powerful Christianity is. When you think about the language we use, you know, American exceptionalism, right? This idea that we are this shining light, you know, and that we were to have this land from sea to shining sea, and it was ordained by God. All shows, it's full of Christian themes and prophecy, and that's what a group of Americans want today. They'd love it if people like you and me left.
Absolutely. We know that, many of us firsthand. So when we think about the way in which religion itself manifests in the United States, isn't it true that there are more and more Americans now who don't even identify with any particular religion? We're seeing sort of Pew Research showing that that more and more Americans are, you know, classifying themselves as none when it comes to asking what their religious beliefs are. And I'm wondering what you think that means.
That population is growing. And what I would say is that doesn't mean that folks aren't religious or spiritual. It's that they are choosing to not necessarily identify with an organized religion. So I don't think necessarily faith is going anywhere, or the way that religion guides people's moralities. You know, I think we also are seeing people picking up parts of faiths that speak to them, and then you can't categorize them, and they don't want to categorize them. But what is important,
and that's an interesting trend, just to interrupt you for a second, because of course eventually or ideally the issue of faith is a personal one. To have or even not have faith is a personal issue, and to see Americans moving in a direction where their faith or their beliefs become more individualistic and less part of, you know, big organized religion might actually mean a level of sophistication in American society that goes against the trend. It's unfortunately far too easy to see organized religion go toward, not all organized religion, but many times organized religions going toward down the path of fundamentalism, whether it's Islam or Christianity or Hinduism or even Buddhism, if you look at some parts of the world.
Yeah, no, and I think though that even when we're talking about the unaffiliated population growing, you know, we're still going to have to work on and deal with white Christian privilege, right? Because it's part of our societal structure. It's part of our legal structure. And that's why it's so important to have people, all different kinds of people, in positions of power making decisions, so that different viewpoints and vantage points ultimately come through. I mean, it will take a couple of generations for sure. I mean, we've got 400 years of white Christian privilege built up right now. Well, and then some, actually, when you think about, you know, going back to Europe and what was done. So that's an important piece, though, because you'll have folks today who, let's say they grew up Christian and they don't affiliate with it now, they can still have Christian privilege. That's an important piece.
Well, Kiyathi Joshi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
My guest has been Kiyathi Joshi. She's a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University and author of New Roots in America's Sacred Ground, Religion, Race, and Ethnicity in Indian America, co-editor of Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice, third edition. We've been discussing her newest book, White Christian Privilege, The Illusion of Religious Equality in America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.